Hey everyone, this is Elijah Johnson with financeandliberty.com, and back with us today is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, you recently came out with the documentary Century of Enslavement, and it's a documentary about the Federal Reserve. I really enjoyed it. Did you want to share with the viewers your purpose behind creating this film?
Well, that's, I think, the important question right now, because I know there's a lot of things that are happening in this world economically and financially and geopolitically, and some people might wonder why I would spend the last 7 months working as hard as I did on creating this documentary. It's about a 90-minute documentary. It's available for free viewing on YouTube and on my website, and the best place that people can go to watch it in its entirety and get the transcript and the resources and the links and everything, it's at corbettreport.com/Federal Reserve, so I hope people will check that out. But the reason that I decided to create this, and the reason why I think it is so important, especially now, especially as we're living through all of these various types of crises, is because I think that the monetary issue is the heart, the absolute root issue at the bottom of all of these crises. And without the ability to finance and to fund the types of military adventurism and geopolitical exploits that are going on right now, I don't think that those types of problems would exist, or at least they would not exist in the form that they do. All of this system that we're facing right now, in all of the various ways that we're facing it, is due to the money creation process and the fact that the basically in 1913, the U.S. government was completely taken over and completely made subservient to the banking interests that managed to form probably the most powerful cartel in the history of the world. And it was the product of a conspiracy, but it is an open conspiracy. There's no part about this that is secretive or hidden in the shadows. So part of what I wanted to do was to show the history of this central bank and how it came about, talk about how how it functions and operates, using mostly the Federal Reserve's own words. There's a lot of the Federal Reserve's own video footage in here and a lot of their own pamphlets and things like that from which we glean this information. And then the final part of this is, well, what can we do about it, and how can we unchain ourselves from this system of enslavement that the Federal Reserve has put the United States and indeed much of the world that relies on the world, the dollar as a reserve currency? How can we unchain ourselves from that system?
And I know you talked a lot about how the American people, even though all the information's out there, it doesn't seem like a lot of the American people really know about the Federal Reserve. You said in the documentary that, quote, our monetary ignorance is artificial, a smokescreen that has been erected on purpose and perpetrated with the help of complicated systems and insufferable economic jargon. Did you want to talk a little bit about that?
I think this is an important point about how this system really operates. We basically have been had it inculcated in us since the time we're children that economics and accounting and all of these things, it's just so boring. It's just dry numbers. And there's all this jargon talking about quantitative easing and all of these things that make no sense. Just by hearing them, you have to actually be steeped in the jargon to understand what it is. So there's a lot of ways that we're turned off by this information before we even start to look at it. So I understand that the prospect of sitting down to watch a 90-minute documentary on the monetary system and how it came about is not something that a lot of people are very eager to do. But probably the best feedback that I've received on this documentary is from people who generally aren't interested in this information, who said that this was actually a really interesting documentary. That's the best that I could hope for, because as I say, I think this is the jargon and the complicated ways in which this system is set up is a smokescreen to hide a very simple truth. And they try to hide that in a lot of different ways. For example, I mean, the Federal Reserve is a quote-unquote decentralized central bank. What does that even mean? Well, it means that there's the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C., and then there's the Federal Reserve banks, which are regional banks, which are openly, admittedly private banks. There's no dispute about that. Even the Federal Reserve itself admits it, as I even have the Federal Reserve's own legal counsel admitting right there in the documentary, so people can see that in there and get the link to that original video. So it has the Washington Board of Governors, it has the Federal have the Federal Reserve regional banks, and then it has the Federal Open Market Committee, which is a combination of the Board of Governors and the regional banks, and there's different systems for voting on the board members for the regional banks, and all of these systems and complicated processes are basically designed to obscure the very simple point that this is a banking cartel that was founded and run and for the benefit of the banking community, and specifically really Wall Street, the big banks in the New York banking community, which is why the New York Federal Reserve, the regional bank for New York, has always been the dominant interest in the Federal Reserve and has always basically called the shots. And that continues, that process continues to this day. And it still is the case that whoever is running the New York Federal Reserve tends to be someone with a great deal of clout and power, and generally in the governmental revolving door ends up as a Treasury Secretary or sometimes as the chairman of the Fed.
Did you want to explain a little bit more on how the Federal Reserve impacts the average person?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the ultimate point is that the Federal Reserve system is a system that institutionalizes a certain monetary creation policy, or a certain way of creating money in the American economy. And basically, I mean, the simplest way of putting it is that the Federal Reserve ends up creating money, which is injected as into the system, or can be taken out of the system through the actions of the Federal Open Market Committee, which basically runs the Federal Reserve's buying operations in the open markets for U.S. Treasury securities. So they can buy or sell these securities, and they buy them with money that they create out of nothing, out of thin air. They just create that money and they inject it into the accounts of the banks that they're buying from or selling to. And with that process, they can basically expand or contract the money supply itself. And of course, they also set the federal funds rate, or at least they target a certain federal funds rate, which sets interest rates throughout the economy. So there's a couple of levers that they have over the economy itself. And of course, we've seen in the last few years, we've seen some of the extra additional facilities and emergency lending and other types of things that they can do, such as just outright buying toxic mortgage debt, which they've been doing in QE3, and outright buying bonds in just a straight monetization of governmental debt. So there are different levers that the Federal Reserve has of running the system overall, but how it impacts the average person is probably made most apparent in when you actually take a look at historical price levels in the United States. And there are some good graphs of this online. I'm sure you can find one in a Google image search or what have you. There's one in a book that I'm reading right now, Truth is a Lonely Warrior by James Perloff, that demonstrates this quite well, where it takes the historical price levels all the way back to 1665. And you note that there are certain spikes and dips in the price levels. For example, during the Revolutionary War, obviously, there was a spike in prices as the Continental currency, which the Continental Congress was printing to fund that war, started to lose its value. So you had a period of sharp inflation there. You see a big spike in the price levels at that point, or during the War of 1812, or during the Civil War, or during World War I. But then around the time of World War II and thereafter, the price levels just go through the roof. It is absolutely just an exponential curve at that point, pretty much straight upwards on the graph. And what is the really determining factor in this? I mean, the Federal Reserve, since the time the Federal Reserve was instituted, the U.S. dollar has lost 97% of its value, which, of course, necessitates certain economic conditions. And to a certain extent, you might say, oh, well, wages inflate as well, so that there's some offset between the eroding value of the dollar and people's upward mobility in terms of wages. But of course, that doesn't get to the heart of what this system is designed to do, which is to discourage people from actually saving in long-term savings, just holding, for example, holding dollars. It encourages them to get into the stock market and to start investing in equities, where they can get a return that will hopefully be higher than inflation itself. And so the system in a lot of different ways functions in subtle ways to benefit those people who are running the financial institutions that undergird this system. So it's one of the reasons that I made this documentary. I think there's a lot of There was a lot of people in the alternative media who sort of understand the Federal Reserve and it's a private banking cartel and it's not a good thing, but they don't really understand why that is or how it functions. It's not simply that the bankers are just running the printing press and creating money for themselves and putting it in their own bank accounts. It's not as simple as that. It's that they use these various mechanisms to direct the economy in various ways, which the Federal Reserve certainly can do, being that big stick and the big lever of power in the monetary system itself. So the entire economy can be directed in different ways, depending on which way they decide to flip that lever. And unfortunately, as we've seen in the last 5 years, basically the Federal Reserve has been blowing up an absolutely unbelievable, historically unprecedented bond bubble and outright propping up the equities so that now we have an overheating equities market that is absolutely designed. I mean, it is a bubble that is going to be popped at a certain point, and it's really just a question of when. So I think that it really does, it is in our best interest to understand how the Federal Reserve works and how it takes a part in that system. And then perhaps even more importantly, what can be done to extract ourselves from that system.
And I'd like to get back to that a little later about, you know, how to extract ourselves from that system. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about, because I know that you showed in your documentary that, you know, people arguing that, well, before the Federal Reserve, you know, there were many currencies that weren't accepted everywhere. You know, they were issued by the banks and it was really confusing. And a lot of financial crises happened and panics. And some people might argue that the financial system was less stable before the Federal Reserve system. And now we've seen a not perfect system, but we've seen, you know, maybe like the Great Depression and the crisis of 2008, but it's, some people might argue, is a lot more stable than it used to be. What is your response to that?
Right. Well, that is certainly the take that the Federal Reserve itself would put out and does put out in its propaganda that it has in various places and that I show to a certain extent in the documentary. But I think that the lie of that is given in the fact that immediately after the creation of the Federal Reserve, well, of course, America entered into World War I in 1917. So just a few years after the creation of the Federal Reserve, we suddenly had a major military involvement that necessitated, of course, increased government spending. And that, of course, was financed through the Federal Reserve and this monetary creation process that they oversee. Of course, after that point, what happened in the 1920s is that the Federal Reserve was directly responsible for the creation of that stock market bubble, which ultimately led to the 1929 crash and then was exacerbated again by the Federal Reserve in its function of basically contracting the monetary supply. There was a huge contraction in monetary supply between 1929 and 1933 that made the stock crash turn into the Great Depression. It wasn't the stock crash itself that actually precipitated the depression. It was the Federal Reserve's policy of contracting the money supply. There was a huge contraction. Money seized up in the economy, and the entire engine fell out of the economy. And that was what the Great Depression was all about. That is, in fact, mainline economic history at this point. And it was at the 90th birthday of Milton Friedman that former Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke admitted as much. He said, yes, we caused the Great Depression, but don't worry, we won't do it again. So that was one example of the lie that all of these panics that we saw in the era of so-called free banking, that the central decentralized central bank was meant to fix that. But I think it's even deeper than that, because when you look back at some of these panics, the panic of 1837, things of this nature, these were, again, quite clearly created by the financiers of the time through various mechanisms. The Bank of England, in fact, was responsible for the panic of 18, were largely responsible for the panic of 1837 because of the ways that they were calling in credit and refusing to take anything but gold and things of that nature that again seized up the American economy. And that can be seen as retribution for the closing of the Second Bank of the United States, which was America's third central bank, which closed operations in 1836. So there's all this, I mean, vastly interesting but detailed history, and I get into some of those details in the first part of the documentary, but perhaps the key panic in relation to the creation of the Federal Reserve occurred in 1907. In the panic of 1907, what we saw was basically an analog to what we saw back in the wake of the Lehman Brothers collapse, where we had the possibility of the complete systemic collapse of the financial system. You saw some of the largest financial institutions on Wall Street at the time, including the Knickerbocker Trust, a direct competitor of J.P. Morgan, that went under as a result of this panic, and there were bank runs that were happening. The entire financial system was in crisis, and lo and behold, J.P. Morgan came along as the financial system's savior. He came along to try to broker a deal, and he managed to get one done where basically the largest financial institutions on Wall Street agreed to underwrite some of the smaller institutions and swallow them up, so that basically we saw a mass consolidation of financial power and wealth in the wake of the panic of 1907. And we also had this idea that J.P. Morgan was some sort of hero and savior of the system. But it, of course, led to the question, well, we can't let this happen again. It must be the fact that we have this free banking system that's to blame. What we need is a central bank. And so it was that there was a congressional committee that was started to investigate the money trust, as it was known at the time, which was the three big banks on Wall Street at the time, as well as some of the key players involved in that, including, of course, J.P. Morgan. And this congressional investigation basically concluded that basically the entire financial system of the U.S. hinged on these banks. That's unacceptable. What we need to do is create some sort of governmental or public entity to oversee the whole system. So that's where the kernel for the idea of the need of the creation of a central bank came into play in the lead up to the creation of the Federal Reserve. But the interesting part of that is when you actually examine the panic of 1907, what precipitated how it came about, it was J.P. Morgan and his associates that really, if not directly caused the panic, certainly exacerbated the panic. And they were the ones that were choosing at that time which institutions to save and which to let go under. And it was, in fact, J.P. Morgan's associates who were most strongly associated with the secret meeting on Jekyll Island in 1910 that became the kernel of the Federal Reserve itself. So what we really have is a type of financial false flag event where you had the bankers who stood the most to gain by creating the banking cartel that was the Federal Reserve, who were the ones who were in fact precipitating the panic. And unfortunately, it was in the wake of the creation of the Federal Reserve and through such things as the stock market crash and the contraction of the Great Depression, again, it was the bankers who were the key players in the financial institutions and system of the time that were the ones that gained from that. And perhaps the most striking example in that regard was Albert H. Wiggin, who was the chairman of Chase National Bank at the time of the Great Depression. And it was just months, fortuitously, it was just 1 month before Black Thursday, 1929, that Wiggin started to sell short the shares of Chase stock. He sold short 42,500 shares just before those shares collapsed. He used his own bank to finance the deal for a $6.5 million loan. He ended up making $4 million in profits on that, shorting his own stock. And ultimately, the Chase National Bank was so happy for his efforts and his ability to make money on the Great Depression that they ultimately voted him a lifetime salary of $100,000 to send him off packing into retirement. So he died a nice, happy, well-fatted man. And unfortunately, again, this is exactly what happens throughout many of these crises. Of course, we had the untold suffering of the people at the very bottom of the food chain, but those at the very top who were well positioned and somehow magically knew when the crash and contraction was going to happen, because they were involved in the financial institutions that helped to make that happen, they tended to not only preserve their wealth, but actually to make wealth during these times of crises. And of course, that continues right down to today, where we saw the most brazen example of that in the wake of the Lehman collapse and all of the 60, or actually as much as $29 trillion has been estimated total, but $16 trillion of emergency lending facilities specifically were investigated by the Government Accountability Office back in 2011, and they issued a pretty startling report that was picked up on by certain media and Senator Bernie Sanders and some others, but largely ignored, that proved that the people who were sitting in the positions of power on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that were directing literally trillions of dollars of these bailouts to the various banks were directing most of these bailouts to their own banks. And I give a couple of examples of that in the documentary of people who were sitting on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York who were directing some of these bailout funds directly to their own banks in a blatant, absolutely undeniable conflict of interest that, again, represents the very heart of this system. It is a system run and operated by bankers for bankers, and in which bankers tend to do very well while the rest of the economy completely melts down.
And I know, as you were talking about the crisis of 2008, I know you had G. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, in your documentary, and he was basically saying that the bankers, they have enough money right now, and what they're looking for is power. And you discussed how they're using the crisis of 2008 to consolidate their political power. Did you want to discuss a little bit about that?
I think this is ultimately the key point, and this brings us back to what I was saying, why I think the Federal Reserve issue, the monetary creation issue, the central banking issue is really at the heart of all of the political issues that we're facing right now. Because at the end of the day, once you realize that they are creating this money out of nothing and they're funding basically whatever they want through these emergency lending facilities, through these panics that they themselves create, at the end of the day, you realize it is not ultimately about dollars and cents. It is not about money, because again, this money means really nothing other than tokens of power. And so it is ultimately the power that I think these people are aiming at. And you can see that operating in various ways. For example, right after the creation of the Federal Reserve, through largely JP Morgan connected interests, you had JP Morgan connected associates forming the Council on Foreign Relations, which was incorporated in New York in 1921, and which featured as its first president JP Morgan's personal lawyer. And the first chairman was a JP Morgan associate, etc. So you had the very same people that were behind the creation of the Federal Reserve creating this Council on Foreign Relations, which explicitly and in its own writings talks about the need for the creation of a new world order, a new political order, a new economic order that they've been aiming at now for 70 or 80 years, which I guess is a long time to be aiming at it. But certainly it is coming further and further into view through creation of organizations and the signing on of the United States onto the World Trade Organization and other such organizations that ultimately erode national sovereignty and seek to create a unified political and economic system in the hands of the very financial interests that have been steering this process. And in the wake of 2008 crisis, we saw, of course, this exact same phenomenon happening, where we had the 2009 London summit of the G8 becoming the G20. That was one of the ramifications of this. And again, we had Gordon Brown and others talking specifically about the need for a new world order. Part of that was the creation of such things as the Financial Stability Board under the broad rubric of the Bank for International Settlements, the Central Bank of Central Banks, which is yet another basically institution that's been created that now is seeking to coordinate and harmonize banking regulations across borders, and is having increasing clout on the international financial stage, creating the possibility of things like the bail-in scenario that we saw in Cyprus just a year and a half ago. We've seen that starting to be standardized through white papers that were created by this FSB that was set up in the wake of the 2008 crisis. So again, I think we see the creation of institutions that seek to undermine the local sovereignty and national sovereignty and seek to place more and more of the power in unaccountable international institutions that represent these centers of power that the bankers operate through. And I think it's extremely important to understand how that process works, because without understanding that ultimately this isn't about money, this is about power, I don't think we can adequately confront it, and I don't think we can adequately understand what's happening in our world today.
And getting back to what you were discussing about earlier, is what can we do to prevent this? How can we possibly, I know in your documentary you talked about ending the Fed. I mean, do you see that as a possibility? And if so, I mean, what would replace it?
Well, it is a possibility, and I want that to be very clear. So I think that's part of what I was talking about in the first part of the documentary, the history of central banking in the United States, because there were three previous central banks in the United States, the Bank of North America, the First Bank of the United States, and the Second Bank of the United States, all of which were ultimately defeated politically, and they were consigned to the dustbin of history. So it has happened before. It can happen again. And there's been a lot of rumors and misinformation that's floated around in the alternative media about the Federal Reserve has a 100-year charter. So there were people saying it was going to expire in December 2013. Of course, it did not, because the Federal Reserve's charter has been amended over the years to the point where the only thing that will ultimately get rid of it is an act of Congress. An act of Congress brought it into existence. An act of Congress can take it out of existence. So in order to actually end the Fed in that sense, it will require political action. And so the tentative steps that we've seen in recent years towards auditing the Fed, presumably as a first step towards that process of ending the Fed, is at the very least hopeful. But I'm not sure how much hope we can really place in that type of baby step towards ending this system. I think the more important point is not putting our faith in some sort of political process that may or may not ever reach that goal. The point is what we can actually do as individuals to start extracting ourselves from this system. And again, this is a long, slow, complicated, difficult process that can only occur in baby steps, but at least they are steps that we can start taking today. So in the third part of the documentary, I start to highlight some of the ideas that float around about different ways that we can start getting around the Federal Reserve system and start extracting ourselves from the Federal Reserve notes that pass for money in our economy. And one of the ways that I highlight in that is Ellen Brown of the Public Banking Institute talking about public banking, the idea that not only do we have federal banks under the Federal Reserve system, but there is still a state banking system in the United States. And state banks can operate, like the Bank of North Dakota, to provide liquidity to banks interest-free if they want to, or with slight interest to recoup expenses and to retire money so that inflation doesn't get rampant, etc. But the point is that there are other ways that we can actually capitalize banks and create a system that is more based on providing money for infrastructure for local projects, etc., rather than creating funny money in collateralized debt obligations and mortgage-backed securities and all of these financial toxic derivatives that have been used in the federal banking system to undergird that system. So we talked to Ellen Brown of the Public Banking Institute about that idea. We talked to Paul Glover, the founder of Ithaca Hours, which is a mutual credit system that started in Ithaca, New York back in the 1990s and has been going for 20 plus years now, has transacted several million dollars worth of these hours, which are basically just a local community credits that are created and are then traded around through the community. Basically, people will offer their services to each other in exchange for these hours, this alternative currency. And people can do all sorts of things through that. In fact, not only supporting local businesses, etc., but local credit union and the local hospital, etc., take these as well. So this is a particularly good example of a mutual credit system that's functioning and that actually does help to bolster a local economy. We also talked to Roger Veer about Bitcoin and the idea of cryptocurrency and how this cryptocurrency completely and utterly gets around central banks and the idea that the monetary supply has to be controlled by some sort of central banking authority. And although I highlight those three particular examples, I do want to stress that there are many, many, many other ideas of different ways that we can circumvent the Federal Reserve system, including one that I am particularly fond of, the idea of self-issued credit, which Paul Grignon has talked about in his works, including Money as Debt, specifically Money as Debt 3, where I think he starts to lay it out more specifically. But the idea that money is not necessarily created out of nothing in the banking system that we have right now. It's created as an obligation that's owed back to the banks that create that money. Basically, we're pledging our service to these banks to repay these auto loans or these mortgages or credit card debt or what have you. We're pledging our service, our work, our labor as the collateral for these loans, and we promise to pay them back over a period of decades. The question is, why do we need the banking middleman in order to do that? And there are people who have been working on this idea of self-issued credit, where basically people underwrite their own credit. And it sounds like a crazy idea at first, but trust me, there is a lot of work that's gone into this and a lot of very interesting proposals out there on that issue. And as I say, many, many, many other ideas for different types of alternative currencies and Let's programs, different ways for people to interact and transact with each other directly without needing the banking middlemen, basically as that parasite on the economy that it ultimately has become. It's not to say that banks are inherently evil, but just the way that the system is structured right now, the main financial institutions on Wall Street tend to dominate the American economy at the expense of everyone else. And surely there are better ways of thinking about how to structure an economy than that. So as I want to stress, the ideas that I put forward at the end of this documentary are not the only ideas. They're not even necessarily ideas that I personally advocate. I just want to start this conversation because there really are dozens and dozens of ideas out there. And I don't think we have to choose only one possible way of transacting with each other. I don't think there has to be one currency or one monetary creation process that you use in your local community versus what you use when you're buying things across state borders versus when you're buying things on the internet online versus stores of wealth, things that you want to use to preserve your wealth over long periods of time. Why can't there be multiple different systems that we choose between as the need arises and as convenience allows? Why not have multiple different backups? So that's ultimately what I want to start exploring. And I don't think this documentary is meant to be the be-all and end-all in terms of solutions, so much as it is to say that there are many solutions out there, and ultimately it is incumbent on us to start working towards them rather than, I think, waiting for that political messiah to come down from the heavens and just hand us a banking system and a monetary creation process that ultimately works for the average person.
Well, James Corbett, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insights. Did you want to share with the viewers any last thoughts you had?
Well, I think ultimately what this is all about is what we can do, what we can actually accomplish ourselves. And I do have hope that we can actually start to extract ourselves from this system, but it is truly a race against time at this point. There are all sorts of worrying signs developing, not only financially, but of course geopolitically right now. And again, it's through crises that the power institutions tend to gain their power and to consolidate and expand that power. So in the wake of World War I, we saw the creation of the League of Nations and the creation of the Council on Foreign Relations and other such institutions. In the wake of World War II, we saw the UN and the IMF, World Bank, Washington Consensus be put into place. One can only imagine what would happen in the wake of a World War III scenario and how much further that would restrict our individual liberty to transact with each other. So I want to just see people starting to think about these issues and to start to prepare and to extract ourselves from the system before that crisis happens. So that's ultimately what this is about. I truly hope people will get this documentary out. If you enjoy it, please get it out to others. It is 100% freely available online, including a complete transcript and links to all sources. So you can go to CorbettReport.com/Federal Reserve again to start watching it for completely for free right now. It's also available as an audio download if you would prefer that. And I hope people will take advantage of that. Of course, if they do want to support this work, I did put 7 months of work into this, an extremely hard effort. So if you do want to support it financially, I do appreciate that. And you can also purchase a DVD copy of this at CorbettReport.com that includes a second disc, not only the documentary, but also the complete 1 hour conversation with J. Edward Griffin is available on a second disc of that 2-disc DVD set.
All right. Well, James Corbett, also, if anybody would want to check out any of your other work, it's also on CorbettReport.com. And once again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity, Elijah. I appreciate it.